pastor, it can be a little bit hard not to sort of be on and be in like task mode and work mode on a Sunday morning. And so your experience of worship can be a little bit different than when you don't have that responsibility at the time. But we have some amazing people that participate in worship with us each week. And pretty much every week there's moments that help me feel like, oh, like I'm letting that release. And I'm fully present in worship with God that same way. And that was definitely true this morning. And so I want to thank everyone who's participating in different roles and just lift that up. That's a really beautiful thing. And I know that whatever many of us may be carrying coming in on a Sunday morning on any given time, that we have those moments and those folks that are offering themselves where God helps us let those some of those things fall into. And so we're thankful for all that. I don't know if some of you have maybe it's certain characters or actors or actresses or genres of shows or movies that you're like, it almost doesn't matter kind of what the other stuff around this is, but, you know, if it's about World War II, if it's about Elizabethan England or something, I'll probably watch it. If Meryl Streep's in it, if this actor's in it, I'm just curious and I want to check it out because I think that that'll be interesting no matter what. Some of us have those interests, you know, that we're really excited about and we'll check it out almost no matter what else is going on. For me, I have a character like that, and that is Sherlock Holmes. I grew up reading all of the books. I thought it was so much fun. Sherlock Holmes is one of the most adapted, maybe the most adapted character in stage, screen, other people writing adapted fictions from that. And if there's something that comes out, I'll at least be curious enough to check it out. Maybe not everything I end up thinking I actually like, but I'll at least try it once to make sure. And one of the things that's, you know, most distinctive about Sherlock Holmes, obviously, is that he can take one tiny bit of information, some smudge of mud on somebody's pant leg, or, you know, their collar being a little bit off somehow, or some other thing he sees no one else would even notice on the ground, and he'll deduce all sorts of things from that to help solve whatever crime or thing that he's investigating. And that power of deduction, that genius that he has, is the thing that's celebrated the most about that character, even though in many portrayals it comes with a decent amount of baggage. And in certain adaptations, the movies that came out recently where Robert Downey Jr. played Sherlock Holmes in particular is an example of this, it doesn't happen as much in the books, but we see not only that deduction of saying, here's some information and I think I can figure out a bunch of stuff about the past to solve a certain case or crime. In that, the action sequences are built around the fact that that same characteristic that Sherlock Holmes has can take a tiny bit of information, one little gesture from someone in a fight, or one little slip of the tongue in a conversation, and he essentially projects forward all of the things that are most likely to happen in the same way. So in those movies in particular, Sherlock takes one tiny bit of information in the present, and his ability to reason and deduce will kind of help him look at way more of the picture than what we normally expect, both in the past and in the future. Now, believe it or not, this characteristic, this way of viewing the world and what can sometimes come along with it, helped me think about the circumstances in the city of Rome when Paul wrote them a letter in the late 50s AD that Becky read from just a few minutes ago. There's some fascinating things happening in the city of Rome right now and in the right then and in the populations of both the Jews and the Gentiles. And there's some evidence, and we can probably see and relate to it here in a second, that that type of setting and environment and actions that were happening were making there be a bunch of little Sherlock Holmeses running around thinking, I know what's going on with these people, I know what's going on with those people, I know what's going on with what's going to come next, even with just tiny bits of information. So at the time that Rome was writing, or that Paul was writing to the city of Rome, he had not visited them yet. Again, it was probably in the late 50s AD. And just a couple years before that, some very powerful things that would have affected Jews and Gentiles living together as Christian communities in particular, like we've seen in our other cities, were happening. First, it's important to know that all Jews were expelled from the city of Rome in 49 AD. Then, when Nero came to power as emperor in 54, probably by conspiring with his mother to murder his adopted father, so a lot of controversy around it, he decided to allow the Jews to come back into the city because he was trying to find as many people that he could get political favor and approval from to tamp down some of the controversy and conflict that could have happened because of how he came to power. We have to remember that this type of swing of who was allowed in the city and who could interact together would have especially impacted early Jewish communities, because in Rome, like in many other cities, it was people of Jewish ethnicity and descent and Jewish religious practice who brought faith in the person of Jesus Christ and started new communities to Rome. So initially, the Roman communities, there's a lot of evidence, did a lot of the things that we've seen in other cities, like Galatia, Thessalonica, where they were emphasizing Jewish practices. Keeping kosher, deciding whether or not to get circumcised, gathering in the synagogue, rooting themselves in Jewish scripture. But then, when all those people were expelled, there were communities and Gentiles who gathered together with them, like in many other places, who were sort of on their own and needing to figure out, what are we going to do now? I mean, we can learn as much as possible, but we don't have the whole history and, you know, personal identity that all the Jewish people that we were gathering in community with had. So, you know, we're also supposed to be starting new types of communities where there wasn't Jew or Gentile lifted up more or less than the other one. So we'll start to figure out what we can do from our own practices that relate to Jesus, from the things that we're familiar with that are meaningful to us, that help us connect to God. And so some new practices started to develop in those communities, and then all of a sudden, a few years later, everyone smashed back together. Maybe some of them had been able to keep in touch a little bit, but for many people, these would have been new relationships, new opportunities that maybe felt exciting at first to connect and practice in inter-ethnicity churches again. But there would also be a lot of tension because there was a lot of controversy. Some people wouldn't have wanted the Jews around again in the first place. Some Jews would have felt like, well, we want to go back to our homes, but we can't trust even Gentiles that might be having some of our faith. We know that even in other cities, like Galatia, like Corinth, like Thessalonica, where they were able to be together all of the time, that those relationships were still really hard to work out. And then complicating it on top of that, one of the biggest pieces of news around the empire at that same time as the Jews were being absorbed back into Rome is that some laws were passed in Judea so that Jews became more second-class citizens compared to the Syrians and other people groups around them. And so they had a rebellion that at first was a peaceful demonstration to the Roman centurions, but then they were attacked by the soldiers. And so then they fought back, and it turned into a big rebellion and giant conflict. And so this was being spread as news all over the empire that there was all this tension ratcheted up, and who are we going to side with? Do we side more with the Jews? Do we side more with the Gentiles? Nero ended up siding more with the Gentiles in that case, even though he had let Jews back into the city and seemed like he might be helping people. So now all these communities are also thinking, well, we don't want to get on Nero's bad side. How should we play this? Should we side more with one set of people? Should we side more with the other set of people? Should we just kind of hide the whole thing? And all of this is hanging over their ability to be close with each other or not. All this potential suspicion, all this potential pressure of who are we going to have make us more safe or less safe? And they're trying to build relationships that they didn't have before because they've been separated. And they would have had all of these assumptions, all of these pressures to say, well, I know you're a Jew, and it means all of this because of all of the external circumstances. I know you're a Gentile, it means all of these other things because of the external circumstances. And so this is what you must think about me. This is how much you'll accept me or not. This is whether or not you'll put me and my family at risk if I'm friends with you, if we're practicing together. People would have been coming up with all sorts of conclusions because of all the things that we're seeing. And so I'm thinking probably, does anyone see how this is a context that Christians in other times and places might also be able to relate to? When there's controversial social circumstances swirling around, when there's people in relationships with each other that have different opinions because of their different backgrounds, because of their different perspectives, because of their different experiences and personalities. And so then this causes all of these extra tensions to build up around us and hang over our interactions. And so then we feel like, I need God's help to help me navigate all of these relationships, all of these pressures, not even disagreements that we might have, because I know that we might disagree about a particular thing, but even the things that aren't disagreements, because even when we're trying to have just good, normal times together, the disagreements feel like they're always in the background waiting to come out at any moment. That thing that Christians have experienced in lots of times and places all throughout history is right at the center of Paul writing to the Romans. And so what does he do to try to offer God's wisdom, to discern how God would help and support this community and navigate those very circumstances? We think of Romans often in scholarship as being Paul's like best theological, very general type of letter. He's just giving the doctrine as thoroughly as possible. If you do a Bible study on Romans, that's normally how it will be written about. But it is important for us to remember this context. Paul didn't have pre-existing relationships with the Roman church. He hadn't been there yet. Maybe he knew some people who were there and had lived in other places and he'd crossed paths with them, but he wouldn't have been close to them like in Corinth, like Robin and I have been talking about, where he spent up to 3 years in the city with all of those people. So he was talking more in generalities, but there is still this very deep pastoral thing that he was thinking. It's not just a theological treatise. It's general, important, foundational theological information that he hopes will be meaningful to their actual context, and we can still receive it that way too. The first thing that Paul does in this letter as he writes is he directly acknowledges the fact that there are differences of experience and perspective and opinion. And then he works in how he writes the letter to weave those differences together, to not allow people to continue to see themselves as separate. So there are sections as we build up to Romans 8 where he says, "I am speaking now to you Jews." And he'll say something that's really specific to what their mindset would have been. And then in a couple chapters later, he'll say very specifically, "I'm speaking now to you Gentiles," and say something really specific to what it would have been on their mind that would be different from the Jewish experience. But then, in each time, he brings it back together and says, "And this is the thing that God does for all of us that helps us understand each other better, connect to each other better, have a path forward together." Also, Paul very powerfully resists the urge to be that Sherlock Holmes type of figure. He doesn't try to project or presume a bunch of different things about this church that he didn't know very well. And then that makes it so that he is inviting them to find a path forward for their community rather than telling them, "I'm going to control your direction through my instructions. You must do it this way for me coming from the outside." Maybe it makes sense because he didn't have those prior relationships, but he very well could have decided, "I'm hearing all this news from outside, I know all the things that are swirling around in their society, and maybe the best thing for me to do is, I'm Paul, people know about me, I've been all over the empire, I'm founding churches all over the place, I can probably step in, I can make all of these wise conclusions about what's happening because of what I've heard, even though it's just small bits of information, I'll do a Sherlock Holmes deduction. And then I will tell them what to do because I have that role and reputation and authority within the Christian church. And then maybe that will just solve the whole thing for them." But the problem is, I think what Paul knew is that this would have been exactly what they were already doing to each other in their own ways and causing more conflict. People saying, "I have this little bit of information. I'm important enough. I have enough rootedness in the Jewish religion where Jesus came up himself, whatever it is. So we're going to solve this thing, and if you don't agree with me, you're just going to have to get dragged along whether you like it or not." So Paul's not only giving wisdom in his words, he's modeling for the Roman church a new way of navigating their tensions and controversies rather than trying to be those Sherlock Holmes presumptive projecting types of people towards each other. Instead of saying, "I'm going to take this one tiny bit of information and assume everything about you and tell you exactly what it looks like for you to do what I like," he says, "Here are some big, important, foundational values and ideas from God. Please, all of you, together, carefully, thoughtfully, make sure that your relationships, make sure that your choices are rooted in that foundation and take those things into consideration. It doesn't mean I'm going to tell you exactly what it looks like to be done, but as your process, make sure you are rooted in these things." And that's a really powerful pastoral approach. It can feel very satisfying and proud to prove how smart and insightful you are. And be that Sherlock Holmes person and know everything, even from small pieces of information. When we're that person that does it, it can feel really gratifying and nice, right? Like, yeah, I figured it all out. Look at how good I am. But when we know we're on the other side of that, and people will try to do that to us, we know that feels really different. When someone is dismissive or demeaning and say, of course I can see your whole picture from one tiny bit of information, no matter how much I know. Of course my insight can be influential for your entire life. We'll see the things that they're missing. We'll see the lack of consideration that is part of that relationship. While they're trying to speak authority to our lives, they're not making relationship be part of what that authority is. And we're prone to reject that for very good reason when people treat us that way. It's very different when instead someone like Paul in this letter asks us to look at something differently from new points of view. Together, we'll both do that. Here's some foundational ideas. Let's get on some common ground together and both look at this differently. Maybe there will mean that there's some change needed to go forward. Maybe there will be some new learning. But we won't be having one person trying to wrest all the control and preference from that. And it's that attitude that Paul brings up from these types of verses that we know actually helps us most understand new things better. To be willing to maybe change our perspectives a little bit. And so the big foundational points that Paul most makes in this letter about new life, about opening up possibilities for how they can be community together, even in all those strange, difficult, swirling circumstances. It's based on finding those common relationships with God's Spirit, enabling them, and it comes to a head in particular in Romans 8. This is kind of the middle of the whole chapter, of the whole letter, and it holds it all together. The things that Paul is lifting up throughout the letter and that hold together most in Romans 8 are that God loves us so much, even though there is so much of how we live and what choices we make and what's happening in our world that God knows is not what is ultimately best. Paul says that God loves everyone, not just certain types of people who are special because of their class or their ethnicity or their status or their background. Paul says that in Jesus, God connected us as closely as possible with Him. And modeled a new way of life where power was shown through love and not through domination. And then Jesus stood up to those values of domination, even to the point of dying because there was so much love for us. And because Jesus did this, the values of the world that say that we have to prove ourselves to be special enough of a person in order to be accepted by God, those values of trying to live up that way don't have any power over who we are anymore or how we connect with God. Instead, we're saved into a new way of life full of God's love just by freely participating in what God is already doing in the world to make things better for all of us. And this connection with God will change our lives right now and it will continue to have power even beyond our death. And lastly, we experience the fullness of God's love as salvation when we treat each other the same way that God treated us, that Paul was just lifting up. And because God treated us that way, hopefully we can take inspiration to treat others that way ourselves. And even more than that, God will not leave us alone, but in fact empower us to treat others along with God the same way that God treated us. And that is that amazing power of the whole book of Romans. And it all comes together in chapter 8 that Becky read for us. That's the thing that any church, especially the Roman church with their circumstances, but our church, any church that relates to those same things, trying to build their relationships and community together, can get foundation and inspiration from. I think Paul saw these verses in chapter 8 as that key linchpin, as the thing that makes it all work, all of those big ideas. If we don't have these key things, it's much harder. But because we do, we're able to do things that are almost impossible, and we're certainly unexpected. The law and the mindset of the Spirit that Paul talks about so much in this chapter, that contrasts with the mindset and the law of the flesh, that's showing the difference between God's values of love and justice and grace that help us navigate the world in a better way than we did before. And those stand against the values of domination and exclusion and selfish pride that so often we see cause destruction and tension in the world around us. And it's really important that that has implications not only for us personally in our connection with God, but for the entire world. Like Paul writes in verses 23 through 27, where he says, all of creation has been groaning with the pains of childbirth from those negative values of domination and exclusion and pride. It's infecting everyone and everything. But God has a solution that brings life to everyone and everything. And it means that we can have a difference in our lives right now, and it will continue to have power after we die. It's as universal as it can possibly be. And the biggest thing that helps us live fully in God's salvation, fully in God's love, away from all of those values of domination and exclusion, it happens in that first verse that we read, verse 8:1. There is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And in many translations, condemnation, and there are reasons that the original Greek word kind of splits the difference on this for how we think of it in English, but it's often translated as shame. There's no shame for those who are in Christ Jesus. And that's really important. Think of how powerful shame is to how we're able to operate in the world, especially in our relationships. I would actually contend that in our culture right now, we have a lot of trouble acknowledging and accounting for the impact of shame. But it's simmering underneath the surface really strongly. And our inability to acknowledge and account for it is what's making some of the most negative things we're seeing in our society expand and deepen and calcify. Think of some of the most painful and hurtful experiences or interactions that you've been a part of. Isn't that feeling of shame, the threat of condemnation, often what we end up being most afraid of and want to avoid, especially emotionally? Isn't the feeling of shame and the threat of condemnation what can be most tempting for us when we're in a conflict with someone else? Because we know that if we use that, we can gain leverage and power over them, make them feel bad, make us feel stronger, even if we know that it makes things worse overall. These are the same exact forces that tempt us into those negative Sherlock Holmes types of assumptions and how we interact with people. And so we can take tiny bits of information or conversation and then project and presume everything else on them in the most negative ways. And sadly, I think this is becoming standard practice in a lot of our cultural conversations, especially on social media, but in a lot of ways that we interact. When shame holds power over us, we get defensive, and we get unwilling to even listen and consider the value of something familiar to us needing to change over time, even a little bit. Because we don't like acknowledging that something that we have enjoyed, that we've been most comfortable with, could need correction, because then we might look shameful that we're connected with something that needs to be different. And then we'll dismiss and dehumanize anybody that wants us to consider their experience and have us do something a little bit different because of what they're bringing to light for us. And maybe open up a new way forward together. And the same thing is true when we hold up shame as being very powerful, we get vindictive and we get self-righteous when we want something to change. We'll try intentionally to shame people who don't see things exactly the way that we do because we know it'll make them feel bad and that might help our preference that much more. And then getting revenge on someone actually becomes sweeter than even the change itself because of that feeling that we cause for ourselves and others. And then we're unwilling to see anything good in what is important to somebody else that's already there. And so we're not able to see something beyond ourselves. We're not able to trust others. We're not able to build something better together. And I'm going to guess that most of us have things in our head that relate to both of those ideas. I would invite you, and I'm going to try to hold myself accountable to this as much as possible too, that when we think of those types of things, that we make sure to see that in ourselves before we see that in everyone else. We know it's happening for all of us around us all the time. But it's really important we know that it's in our hearts before we go after someone, before we get in their hearts too. But then think about how powerful it is when shame gets taken off the table. I don't know if you've ever had those types of interactions before, where someone has just been able to completely diffuse something that seems like it's going to blow up because they're like, yeah, I'm not worried about that the same way that everyone seems to be. This often happens most in long-term friendships and maybe spousal relationships where we get to be comfortable with each other, but it can happen in almost anything. And again, it's really, really powerful when it happens. When someone brings up that problem and it seems like things are going to spin out of control, and the person just says, yeah, you're right. That wasn't great on my part. How can I make it right? How can we move forward together? I don't feel horrible about the fact that you're showing me that something is wrong, but I'm comfortable enough to also acknowledge it and then see if we can work on it together. When we're angry, it completely takes all the angry energy out of the situation. Because you can say, the person's listening to me. They're acknowledging that my perspective is valid. I don't have to escalate it. I don't have to shout at them. I don't have to make them feel horrible. Sometimes when people treat us that way, it actually can make us a little bit frustrated. Like, oh, I wanted the power of my anger. I wanted to make you feel horrible. But if we're open to it, like, to be able to release that and just work on things together is so much better. On the other hand, sometimes we'll have felt awkward. And we think, oh, I shouldn't bring up something that's important to me because I will make someone feel bad. I don't want to make someone feel bad. I want to be nice. And we have trouble setting healthy boundaries or talking about things that really do matter to us. And then we end up being resentful. But if someone can say, yeah, of course, tell me. I'll hear it out. I don't feel horrible about myself because you're telling me this, but I want to know. You say, oh, I don't have to feel bad about making them feel bad. They're comfortable. I can say the things that are important to me and we can do something about it together. And again, sometimes we feel like I'm losing my moral superiority. I like the fact that they were kind of hurting me, and I get to think in my head about how they're a bad person because they're hurting me and not acknowledging the thing that they should have on their own. But if we open ourselves up to it, it's amazing to just be able to do that together with someone who's not threatened by the idea of like, yeah, I should keep improving, I should keep working with the people around. But I think that's one of the rarest and most difficult things to have come up in our communication nowadays. It is really difficult, but it's also, we hear from these exact verses, one of the biggest gifts that God can give us for our lives, for our sense of self, so that we don't have to feel junky all the time. For our relationships, so we're not stuck in unhealthy conflict with each other all the time. And for the betterment of the world, and having the ability to see things transformed for the good of all people more often in more meaningful ways. Taking shame off the table because we are confident in God's love has the power to do all of that. It's definitely not easy, but it's so beautiful when we open ourselves up to God doing this in our lives instead of resisting it. We may want to feel more powerful, more comfortable, better than other people, but God's love allows us to say, I'm not afraid of you that I'm not perfect. I know even things that I care about still need God's transformation, just like anything else. And it doesn't make me a horrible person or outside of God's love if that's true. And God's love also allows us to say, when we want change, when we want something different, when we want people to see things that they're not opening themselves up to, we can say, I trust God to be in control of salvation, to be in control of new life, to work for it, even if I'm not seeing the progress I want. I know that God is always moving for what is needed. So I can be patient. I can be empathetic. I can be encouraging and share in the process of transformation and salvation with others together. Sometimes I'll need it. Sometimes I'll be able to be helpful to other people. And we'll all be together and better moving forward towards those changes and transformations because God's love is empowering us to do it. You might wonder if this is really possible. You might be thinking of all the things you've seen on social media, all the awkward conversations you've had, all the times that people have been angry at you and you've had those feelings and rest off and think, is this actually even possible? Is this just some nice words that Paul threw out there and then Rob, you know, gave 25 minutes on for a while? I encourage you to consider those words, especially from Hosea, as you think about whether or not that's really possible and offered to us. Remember, that book is dealing with the most shameful things that Israel and Judah could have been doing. The worst corruption of worship. The most exploitative domination and oppression of other people by their culture. All the worst injustices. And even in those circumstances, God calls this prophet, Hosea, to do everything that's possible to show how God's love really does offer salvation and new life and freedom from shame, no matter what. I won't get into it too much, but Hosea is called to marry a prostitute that God knows is not going to change her life because Hosea married her. And Hosea's faithfulness to her, continuing to go along as a family, shows what God is doing for the people of Israel. So I encourage you, in anything that you would want to say about yourself or someone else because of shame, you're not God's loved one. Remember the words of Hosea, you are God's beloved, even when you think that shame could have as much power over you. And anything that you would say about yourself or someone else, you are not one of God's people. Remember, God called us all a family. All of us able to join with God in infusing the world with salvation and new life. God loves you and all those you come into contact with that way, with that much power, even in the things that we think would be the most difficult. And this salvation and this new life can open us up to try, to trust in God's love. In the coming days and weeks, give it a shot. See, can I be vulnerable enough to ask God, show me those things where shame is having power over my life, where I'm getting defensive towards listening, I'm getting vindictive to people who I want to be different, and I'm trying to hurt them. And ask God, help me be free of that. I don't want that to be a part of my life anymore. And imagine the amazing impact that this can have in your life. And not only that, in a world, in our other interactions, when we invite people from our freedom to share it and experience their own freedom from this. The amazing impact that we have where we know how much shame affects things right now. But God has something so, so much better for us. So we reflect on that and kind of follow God. I'll invite Camilla to share some of what she's experienced following God this year to pray for our offering.